You know the story of the premiere of Rite of Spring in 1913. It was truly the shock of the new, the stomping choreography, the jarring rhythms, the dissonance, and the audience erupted. Well, Rite of Spring wasn't the half of it.
In a lot of ways, it was just the beginning of a century of absolute chaos. And as so often, the artists heard it and reflected it first.
1913 is when modernism came out of all kinds of artist studios and slapped everybody in the face.
So much of modernism, whether you're listening to it or reading it, initially is ugly.
And certainly very many were quite certain this one was a great man and was one clearly expressing something.
Today in Studio 360, we'll explore a pivotal year that changed everything. A documentary on the centennial of culture shock, 1913. That's ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of Studio 360 from Public Radio International and WNYC, where each week Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. We have a great website, too. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
I'm Kurt Anderson. This is Studio 360. No matter how sophisticated you may be, you've had this experience. You see some work of art and think, that isn't art. I don't know what it is, but it's not art. And it doesn't seem funny. It irritates you, confuses you, maybe even makes you angry. When that happens, you're catching a ripple of a stone dropped 100 years ago. Or not a stone, but a bombshell, a series of bombshells that once and for all brought an end to 19th century culture. Today we're devoting our program to a great new radio documentary, Culture Shock 1913, produced by Sarah Fischko for New York's WNYC. And Sarah is here with me. Sarah, we're going to hear a custom-tailored version of your program in just a minute, but I have some questions for you first.
All right.
So of the events of that pivotal year of 1913 that you cover in this program, what surprised you the most?
I think the biggest surprise was that with all the attention that's given to Rite of Spring, that there were so many others. Not that there's any one in particular that was so spectacular. They were all spectacular, and they were so varied and so interesting that they make the Rite of Spring look like just another thing that happened that
That's
year.
Just what 1913 was about.
Yeah.
And back then, back in 1913, how did the for and against sentiment among the critics and gatekeepers break down? Were there some people who said, oh, this is good?
Yes, of course there were people who said this is good, although many of those people tended to be artists, because I think one clear message of that period is that the artists were a bit ahead of the game. They saw things that not everybody could see.
And comparing it to eras in our lifetimes, is it comparable to, say, 1968 to the late 60s in terms of the shock of the new?
I think the thing that's different about this period is that it was the form that changed, not the content. It's easy to find periods where the content changes because people are responding to what's happening. But this was a moment where the form of art wasn't enough to reflect the content. They had to find a new form, and that's a stunning thing.
That it happened, and as we're about to hear, in so many different realms at once.
Yes.
Well, without further ado, here is Culture Shock 1913 from WNYC's Sarah Fischko.
Thanks, Kurt.
Shock is good, said artist Marcel Duchamp. He ought to know, he who sent shockwaves through the art world several times, first with his painting Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2, the star of the Armory Show in 1913.
Well, even while you were working in the cubist style, you nonetheless managed to produce a cubist painting, the Nude Descending a Staircase, which shocked the cubists.
Yes.
Why did
yeah.
it shock them so much?
When I came with my Nude Descending the Staircase, they'd didn't see that it applied to their theory.
In Paris, and later in New York, the abstracted image and the irreverent title of Duchamp's famous painting scandalized all who saw it.
So they thought it was too much neither one, nor futurist, nor cubism, and they condemned it.
Condemned in Paris, reviled in New York, which is where our story begins. Democrat Woodrow Wilson was just about to take office as the 28th president. Silent movies were all the rage, and Enrico Caruso was a major star, having become a fixture at the Met and sold millions of records since 1904. Up and down the city, billboards and posters announced the upcoming opening in February of a major art show at the 25th Street and Lexington Avenue Armory, presenting the latest in European art.
Dr. Brown, the Armory at Lexington and 25th Street is a...
Author and art historian Milton Brown spoke about it on the Armory Show's 50th anniversary for the radio program Observation Point.
The Armory Show was actually a break in the development of American art. It was probably the most important exhibition that was ever held in this country, and as an art exhibition, probably had the greatest effect that any ever had. It was the introduction of modern art to America.
The introduction of modern art to America. Just think of it.
What was happening in our art world in 1913? Were we completely conservative or orthodox in our tastes in art?
I think that was the trouble. Nothing was happening. American art was dominated by academic standards and what was called the academy. There were many academies in the country. They tended to dominate aesthetic standards as well as exhibition facilities, and there was very little opportunity for young, unknown, or progressive artists who were not academic to show.
The interesting thing about the Armory Show is that it was organized not by entrepreneurs, professional art exhibitors, or event producers. It was organized by artists who were fed up with the tyranny of the academy. So they formed an artists' association, and in 1912, three of them, Walt Kuhn, Arthur B. Davies, and Walter Puck, took the long 10-day journey by boat to Paris to find examples of the art revolution taking place in Europe. In Paris, where Debussy was writing adventurous piano preludes, the Americans encountered young painters like Picasso and Braque, who had started to break apart images in the most dramatic way, altering reality, dividing canvases into fragments and piecing them together. By 1913, others from Italy and Russia had joined them in this. It was a complete departure from the art of conventional portraits and sedate landscapes.
What Picasso and Braque were trying to do was invent a new language of painting.
Museum of Modern Art chief curator Ann Temkin.
So that a shoulder didn't look like a shoulder looked like a group of lines that intersected, not because they needed to show people what a shoulder was, but because of the intersection of that group of lines made for an interesting looking structure on a canvas. So the priority was shifted completely away from being true to what you would see, for example, in a photograph, and instead emphasizing that what was on the canvas was an interesting thing to look at, even if it didn't look like anything that you could identify.
The American painters abroad visited artists who led them to other artists. They went to galleries and studios and found hundreds of the most interesting works to bring back to America in crates on another long boat ride. How they managed to engineer all this, it is hard to imagine.
And so they felt that if they could get together and do a mammoth exhibition, they could really wake America up.
And how many paintings were in this exhibition in 1913?
We can't be exact about it, but approximately 1,300.
1,300 European and American artworks.
I'm here to see Captain Gendron.
For $5,000, the artist organizers rented not a gallery, not a space intended for art,
the door on the left,
but the 69th Regiment Armory, which had just been built a few years before. Giant space.
Okay.
The building takes up a little more than an acre, 62,235 square feet.
Welcome. Thank you.
First time here?
The Armory at 25th Street in Lexington still hangs a reproduction of Nude Descending a Staircase in a special display window devoted to this chapter in its cultural history.
But I believe it came out from this wall here.
The artists liked the fact that the Armory wasn't a museum or a gallery. They wanted a big open space where they could pack people in.
The art show of 1913, that's the space as it looked in 1906. The drill floor is a total of 26,000 square feet, so I can actually.
The association built multiple octagonal walls to divide the giant area into room-like spaces devoted to various artists and styles. The show featured many American paintings of different kinds, and in one area, which became known as the Chamber of Horrors, were Cubist paintings by Picasso, Braque, Leger, and several works of Marcel Duchamp, including the notorious Nude Descending a Staircase No. 2. That painting, above all others, created an uproar among critics, commentators, and some angry viewers, art historian Kimberly Orcutt reminds us.
A lot of the complaints of Duchamp's nude really, in the end, take the form of the question, where's the nude? They want to be able to immediately discern the nude, and this idea that a painting would purposefully not express what the title is was considered kind of a breach.
It came across as a break in the kind of unspoken contract between artist and viewer, which had been pretty straightforward up to this point, a title and a subject that could be clearly comprehended. With the cubists and abstract painters, all bets were off. Author Alec Nevala-Lee.
A newspaper offered a prize to the first person who could spot the nude in that painting.
And there was that title, which itself violated well-established principles about what a nude in a painting was permitted to do.
Nudes were allowed to recline, they were allowed to stand, but the idea of a nude getting up and going downstairs, I think, is what upset people more than anything else.
And the artist had tried to compress the nude's whole walk down the staircase into one image.
Duchamp's great angle in making the picture is putting her in motion. So doing something that's photographic, not even photographic, filmic with something on a canvas.
Filmic had real meaning at that time. Film was an emerging form of art and even more entertainment. Right then, in 1913, D.W. Griffith had just finished making 450 short films over the last 5 years during a period when brand new notions of movement, storytelling, and editing were being born. Tom Gunning is a film historian and a Griffith scholar.
What Griffith does do is begin to think about how can you tell stories without dialogue, with a minimum of words. There are a few very brief uses of intertitles. And editing becomes his tool, which is to say, you know, articulating the film into fragments. And those fragments are fragments of space and time.
Before this moment, filmmakers would set up a camera, say 10 or 12 feet away from their subjects, and shoot. What Griffith and a few of his contemporaries began to create was the modern language of film. They realized they could vary the impact of an image by shooting close-ups, by cutting the length of shots, and by cross-cutting from one scene to another.
So that you're telling a story by the way that you control viewpoint and detail and emphasis.
Film, which was able to distort time and create its own shocking images, had a growing popular audience, as well as an audience of artists.
So this image of a kind of modern, unstable, crazy world, surrealism before surrealism is invented, is there in the cinema. And definitely Picasso, Braque, all these people are crazy about the movies.
The Armory Show was everything it was intended to be and more. It was eventually seen by 500,000 people. Former President Teddy Roosevelt turned up at the show, and in an op-ed piece he called the artists who were creating modern work extremists. And he alluded to Duchamp's painting by describing, in his words, a picture of a misshapen nude woman, repellent from every standpoint. Even so, the Armory Show art gained traction, and abstraction and modernism did break the hold of the academic tradition. But artists and creators had been presenting these challenges for a while. To look for a new approach to a visual structure, you could walk over to the Eiffel Tower, for example, which had already knocked people for a loop in 1889.
Madame, Monsieur, vous ici du premier étage sur le sud, des restaurants, en effet, l'exposition boutique.
It's just that I would like to go up in it to see what it looks like from the inside.
If you were in Paris in the late 1880s, you were for it or you were against it. It was what is now seen as an early modernist masterpiece, that tall tower built by Gustave Eiffel out of around 18,000 pre-constructed interchangeable parts. It had been built as a temporary thing to dress up the Universal Exhibition.
You have to see an iconic structure, which is much talked about. So we don't mind waiting the 2 hours probably today because only the one lift is working.
Anne Temkin of the Museum of Modern Art says the tower, then the tallest man-made structure in the world, was a catalyst for all kinds of debates and emotions about modernity.
Do you know that over 30 million people went to Paris that summer in 1889 to see this Universal Exhibition? I mean, imagine in the 19th century, 30 million people getting themselves to Paris. I think it was 200 acres of Paris were overtaken with special exhibitions about modern technology, modern design, of course, modern art.
We know it was made for exhibition at some point of time to be demolished after the exhibition, but somehow people liked it. And in the beginning, there was a reaction, I think, that it's not so good. And then once you see the thing, you probably like it. So then it just stayed around.
It's true. There were massive protests from artists and non-artists alike who feared the tower would be a hideous blight on the beautiful city of Paris. Even after it was built, they protested. Popular writer Guy de Maupassant famously ate lunch at the base of the tower every day. He said it was the only place in Paris he could have lunch where he didn't have to look at the Eiffel Tower.
Yeah, it looked ugly to people in the beginning. And once you start looking at the same thing, you probably start liking it, I think.
It looks ugly at the beginning, but then you look at it, and you look at it, and you start to like it. The story of culture shock. The story of modernism in a nutshell.
So much of modernism, whether you're listening to it or reading it or seeing it, initially is ugly. Because I think one way of defining beauty in a funny way is the familiar. What's beautiful to you is what you recognize, what you know. And what's ugly is what you can't fit into your expectation of what something should look like or sound like. And so invariably throughout the course of this 100-year period, whether we're talking about paintings by Matisse or various concerts, various books, the critics' initial reaction, let alone the general public's, was this is absolute baloney.
This is Studio 360. Today we're presenting Culture Shock 1913. A documentary produced by WNYC's Sarah Fischko about that critical year, exactly a century ago, when the modern fully blossomed. This is music, or noise, depending on your tastes, composed in 1913 by the artist Marcel Duchamp. And coming up, a riot in one of Europe's most historic concert halls.
Well, it had to be stopped. The uproar was too extreme. Fights had broken out. The police were called. It really had dissolved completely into chaos.
And that's ahead in Culture Shock 1913. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Today, we're doing a centennial look back to the cultural landmark year 1913 in a new documentary called Culture Shock 1913. It explores the unsettling currents that led to and were unleashed during that year and really changed forever how we define and understand and experience art. Before the break, we heard about the Armory Show, which introduced radical European art ideas to conservative American tastes. We'll continue now with Culture Shock 1913, produced by Sarah Fischko for WNYC.
So you have to ask, what had happened to the culture to allow and encourage these powerful art excursions into new territory? What was going on? You could say European culture in general was in a state of shock.
I think it was a shock.
Philip Blom, whose book about pre-World War I Europe is called The Vertigo Years, maintains this era threw people off balance. It was exhilarating but also dizzying to witness so much dramatic change so fast.
The realities on the ground had become completely different. Where there had been a city of 100,000, there was now a city of 2 million. Where your parents had worked in a rhythm that was dictated by weeks, you were now in a rhythm that was dictated by minutes because you had to clock in and the telephone rang and things like that.
Nothing traditional really makes sense anymore and satisfies anymore.
Frederick Morton wrote Thunder at Twilight about 1913 and 14 in Vienna.
There is something other that is real. So Picasso's Cubism and the Italian Futurism and later on the Soviet-Russian Constructivism, they were all related, not the things that we have seen until now and that we have seen on canvases or that we heard in concert halls. It does not respond to our real needs.
There were complicated needs brought about by even more complicated internal revelations.
Think of Freud, who said that your sexual impulses that are repressed, because you have to be a decent person, you can't be seen to covet someone, you can't be behaving in a way that is not acceptable to society, well, that's actually bad for you. And you should learn to get in touch with those urges, and you should accept the fact that children have sexual thoughts. These were frightening things. These were terrible things at the time. I think they are still frightening and rather terrible to some people today.
And even this science, which was introducing those terrifying ideas for the first time, had its own factions and uncertainties right at that moment. The Austrian neurologist Sigmund Freud and the Swiss psychologist Carl Jung had been excitedly corresponding and comparing notes on practices, problems, and dreams.
Jung was very interested in dreams. He was very interested in his own dreams.
Later, Jungian analyst Diane Fremont notes, Freud and Jung traveled together.
And on this trip to America, they were analyzing each other's dreams and disagreeing about how to analyze them.
That was in 1909. By 1913, they found themselves in the same room at the same time at the 4th International Psychoanalytic Conference. It was September of 1913.
Oh, of course. I mean, that was the time of the great civil war within psychoanalysis. Jung really, for the first time, came out against Freud. That psychoanalytic congress in Munich really produced a showdown between the two.
I couldn't agree with quite a number of his ideas.
Carl Jung was interviewed about Freud many years later.
Well, chiefly his purely personal approach and his disregard of the historical conditions of man.
There's no question that the presence of two ambitious thinkers studying and writing and attending conferences and arguing about the unconscious mind and dreams and sexual impulses had a profound effect. The thinking of both of them was radical.
Up until around 1850, the sort of dominant view was the view of the Enlightenment, the Age of Reason, which in its extreme form thought of human beings as being very specially created by God to be rational creatures and to be guided by deep insight.
Neuroscientist and Nobel laureate Dr. Eric Kandel says this long-held view was challenged by modernism.
Modernists were influenced by Darwin, who argued that human beings were not specially created but evolved from simple animal ancestors. And there was very good evidence through the work of Freud that human beings were not completely rational, but driven importantly by unconscious instincts, as Darwin had suggested and as Freud elaborated.
This radical rethinking that had come about at the end of the 19th century and the earliest years of the 20th was now building, and it was reflected in the art.
Many artists and writers were reading Freud and Jung and reading psychological work, so there was an inter-fermentation, I think, certainly in the culture at that time. And there was much less delineation between art, writing, literature, psychology. Jung had these conferences yearly where scientists, artists, writers, everyone would come together and talk about ideas.
There were coffee houses that had very important social roles where people of different disciplines met, and people were less afraid of artists speaking with scientists and vice versa.
Just around this time, composer Arnold Schoenberg wrote to his friend, the painter Kandinsky, "Art," he said, "belongs to the unconscious." On to Vienna, where a Schoenberg scandal was about to erupt.
Well, then, first of all, I'd like to welcome all of you here to music, and thank you very much for visiting our house. We are standing right in the middle of the so-called music front already, because normally...
I'm with a group taking the tour of Vienna's greatest, most historic concert hall, the Musikverein. They're doing a little construction here, but you can still see the massive amounts of gold leaf and feel the great history of the place. Johannes Brahms was the director here in the 19th century. Every great international concert artist has performed here. In fact, this is the place where, every New Year's Eve for the last century and more, Viennese waltzes have rung out the old and rung in the new. But Magdalena Manhara, our tour guide, says people still talk about what happened in this very spot in March of 1913.
The most famous incident is the, we call it Watschen concert. Watschen means, in English means, if you slap somebody's face. It happened in 1913 when...
The slap in the face was mutual. The audience felt slapped in the face by the music. The conductor, Arnold Schoenberg, was almost slapped in the face by the audience, not long after he got on stage to conduct a performance of music of his own, as well as pieces by his colleagues, Berg and Webern. After a short time, there were protests in this bastion of respectable classical music. Music critic Alex Ross.
It had to be stopped. The uproar was too extreme. Fights had broken out. The police were called because it really had dissolved completely into chaos.
And the Golden Hall of the Musikverein was cleared of all audience members by a combination of police, firefighters, and other officials who sensed a riot in the making. Schoenberg was almost lynched, people climbing on stage, supporters and opponents of the music arguing aggressively.
It was the most famous scandal of the beginning of the 20th century. It filled newspapers.
Tourists may chuckle about it now, but in 1913 it was very serious business. But as dramatic as it sounds, it had been building up to this point for a while. What Schoenberg, Berg, and Webern were doing, the music that provoked what is now known as the Skandalkonzert of 1913, was an extension of a breaking apart of tradition that had started a while back.
Especially in the decade of the 1880s.
Audiences were already starting to feel a certain unease about some departures from tradition, particular chords and musical combinations.
That was the period when Liszt was writing his final works. Debussy was beginning to explore these new areas of harmony.
And they floated around tonality in a new way, says pianist Jeremy Denk.
Until the harmony is floating completely away. You would never do... In that music, that's the antithesis of that music is to resolve it. It's about something else.
But it was really not until the very beginning of the 20th century that audiences began to perceive this new harmonic language and began to take fright at it, in a sense.
Schoenberg and his colleagues were using a free atonal style, which later evolved into his famous 12-tone system, in which, as he said, the notes were related only to each other rather than to a particular key. It was hard for people to hear.
I think part of it is actually that Schoenberg has a complete language in these works.
Composer and Schoenberg biographer Alan Shawn.
The coherence, the density, the quality of it makes it kind of monolithic. If you don't enter it, you don't enter it, you know.
The abandonment of conventional musical rules was a shock even for the people writing the music. They had left tonality and couldn't turn back. And especially Anton Webern felt it acutely.
Webern uses the word panic about that moment in their work when they realized that it no longer actually was true to the piece to pretend that it had been tonal. To simply display a tonal coat of arms, to use Jernberg's phrase, at the end of a piece when it hasn't been tonal at any other point felt dishonest and ridiculous.
Like an artificial facade, perhaps.
There seems to have been a great preoccupation with facades and what's behind them.
Philip Blom, author of The Vertigo Years.
So already you had a feeling of a disjunction between what was shown and what was actually happening behind that. And you see that very strongly in the writings of Sigmund Freud, for instance, who of course writes about that, who says the bourgeois facades that we have to put on, they may actually be bad for us. And anyway, they don't represent what's really going on inside us. And that is something that you see very strongly in the art of that time, that people try to look behind the facade of a tradition at what is really functioning, how things really work. And you can think of Schoenberg in that context and think, well, he really wanted to break down music to its constituent elements. But you also see the early architecture that does that. You say, let's get rid of this facade. Let's just expose the functional elements of a building. You see that in painting where, as it were, the paintings are stripped down right to the bare minimum.
Despite the Skandalkonzert, Arnold Schoenberg, says critic and author Alex Ross, was not a provocateur, but a very serious man committed to his way into the new.
I would say he is the most radical thinker of this entire period. And there's no doubt in my mind, you know, of the two great riots that occurred in the year 1913, the Schoenberg riot in Vienna, March 31st, was the more severe, the more serious, the more violent. That was a real break. That was a real confrontation between a composer and the audience, many of whom very strongly rejected what he was proposing.
This is Studio 360. Today we're presenting Culture Shock 1913, a documentary produced by WNYC's Sarah Fischko. 1913 was a year of confrontations between artists and audiences, artists and other artists, between people and the strange, scary, intoxicating new modern life they were thrust into.
You know, we read in the paper all the time about how our life is going to change because there's Facebook and there's the internet and the cell phone. These people did it all the time. There was electric light, there was the automobile, there was, you know, much more than a cell phone. And people were, and the elevator, and people were telling them that, you know, forget what you know, it's going to be irrelevant.
That's ahead in Culture Shock 1913. This is Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. And by The Gathering Ireland 2013, a year-long celebration of Irish music, fun, culture, and lots more. For those interested in uncovering their roots, renewing a love of Ireland, or discovering it for the first time. More information at discoverireland.com.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson. Our entire program today is devoted to a new documentary on the year 1913 and the series of shockwaves in the culture that really haven't subsided even now. Sarah Fischko produced Culture Shock 1913 for New York's WNYC.
So you have to look at what happened in 1913 in a generational manner. People born all around the same time came of age confronting a set of common problems.
Conductor and educator Leon Botstein.
The same way we talk about, you know, we read in the paper all the time about how our life is going to change because there's Facebook and there's the internet and the cell phone. These people did it all the time. There was electric light, there was the automobile, there was, you know, much more than a cell phone. And people were, the elevator, and people were telling them that, you know, forget what you know, it's going to be irrelevant.
Forget what you know. That was certainly how the Italian futurists looked at it. Luigi Russolo created the art of noise. Silence, he said, was a 19th century thing.
He
developed these intonarumori, or noise intoners.
NYU Italian Studies professor Ada Mergen.
In order to experiment with various sounds, many of which were drawn from the urban environment.
Russolo and his compatriots were eager to bury the past, burn the old paintings, shatter the quiet of the past century. Many miles away, Russian futurism was alive as well. Velimir Klebnikov, futurist poet, wrote, "We rang for room service, and the year 1913 answered. It gave planet Earth a valiant new race of people, the heroic Futurians." Russian painter Kazimir Malevich painted the first black square painting in 1913. Just that, a black square on a white background. He was the founder of the abstract art movement known as suprematism.
Within all of these isms, the individual artists have very distinct voices.
Museum of Modern Art curator Anne Temkin.
However, one thing that I think was important to all of these artists was that the value was placed on being new. And this is an absolute contradiction to what the 19th century academic tradition would have been, which is to do what the people before you were doing perfectly, or even better.
Just to excel in what you were taught and conform to what you were taught had been enough before this.
And instead, with modernism, the idea was absolutely toss away what it is one would have been taught in school and invent something that nobody in the world had thought up before you thought it up.
What is the use of a violent kind of delightfulness if there is no pleasure in not getting tired of it? The question does not come before there is a quotation. In any kind of place, there
Joyce
is
was working on Ulysses. Kafka, Proust, and Pound were working on soon-to-be-celebrated works. And Gertrude Stein's Tender Buttons, just written in 1912, was about to be published. And the fragments that were finding their way into paintings and music were affecting structure and sound and syntax.
And wear it and then be reckless and resolved on returning gratitude.
In Tender Buttons, Stein's words shatter structure.
Any neglect of many particles to a cracking, any neglect of this makes around it what is lead in color and certainly discolor in silver.
So in this poem, she really invents wordness.
Poet and teacher Charles Bernstein.
You feel the words themselves stripped of or liberated from their burden of representation or the necessity for them to function as representation. So what would it be like for language to convey just its own verbalness, its wordness?
And suppose it was actual. Suppose the mean way to state it was occasional. If you suppose this in August and even more melodiously, if you suppose this in even the necessary...
Stein continued along these lines for decades, and it still sounded new much later, as in If I Told Him, a completed portrait of Picasso, which Stein herself recorded in the 30s.
And as he. He is, and as he is, and as he is, and he is. He is, and as he, and as he is, and he.
They were the same familiar individual words, combined and manipulated so as to catch the ear in a completely new way. Which leads us to The Rite of Spring. The most famous bassoon solo in the history of music. Even just that, played in the extreme high register of an instrument known best for its lowness, was enough to send chills up the spines of the privileged audience, hearing its legendary first performance in Paris that spring of 1913. The famous first night of the Ballet Russe production of The Rite of Spring is probably the best-known cultural reset, the best-known one-night revolution ever. Its kind of before and after status has put it in a special touchstone category.
The most famous event in all of 1913 artistic history, which
Leon Botstein, who's been giving lectures lately about the score and the scandal,
of The Rite of Spring,
says it's hard to remember a time when art made a difference, which on that night it certainly did.
And that people were actually scandalized by what they consider to be an offensive artistic pretense. So it's fascinating to look back at a time where people got upset about what music was being written. And the response wasn't either to ignore it or just to shut it off.
They couldn't shut it off on May 29th, 1913, at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées in Paris. Not the music by Stravinsky, not the costumes and scenic design by Nicholas Roerich, not the choreography by Vaclav Nijinsky, says New Yorker writer and author Joan Acacella.
It could not have been more anti-balletic, more different from ballet if it had tried.
Ballet in the late 19th century was fluid and beautiful. It was defined by a soft, curving style.
You can think of the music in that way, but also ballet with the beautifully curved arms, the beautifully separated fingers. All of this is rounded, gradual, sweet, lyrical. It looks like, well, I mean, in the crudest case, it looks like something that would be on the cover of a card, a greeting card.
In The Rite of Spring, the dancing and the music were perfect examples of that moment's interest in what was then called primitivism.
It involved bent knees, feet either straight forward or turned in, pigeon-toed, shuffling, jumping on flat feet. Well, nobody had ever seen anything like it before.
The shocking premiere has been dramatized in several movies, including the pretty trashy Herbert Ross biopic, Nijinsky.
We are told that poor Nijinsky stood in the wings screaming the counts to the dancers because the noise in the theater was so loud that the dancers could not hear the orchestra. That is the story.
So how to understand an audience making this scene?
There's a continuing controversy about what the riot was really over, the music or the choreography.
Joan Acacella says Stravinsky wrote in an early memoir that he thought it was about the choreography, of course.
He said that Nijinsky was ignorant of music, the choreography was bad, and that this is what the riot was over. Many people feel, on the contrary, that what sparked the riot was really the music. And then the kind of primitive stuff, um-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum-bum.
This rhythm, this pulsing rhythm,
you know, people, I think, you know, their jaws dropped over this.
And the accents keep landing in different places.
Author and critic Alex Ross.
Well, we now think of it as this enormous vitality, but at the time I think it must have seemed like this really alien force bearing down on the audience, and they rebelled.
And then there was the response to the dissenters who were making so much noise.
Protesting, mumbling, muttering, whistling. The enthusiasts struck back very loudly, very violently. After a certain point, people couldn't even have been listening to the music.
From the diaries of Count Harry Kessler, Paris, May 29, 1913. In the evening, the premiere of The Rite of Spring, a thoroughly new vision, something never before seen, he writes, enthralling, persuasive, a new kind of wildness, both un-art and art at the same time. The public, the most elegant house I have ever seen in Paris, was from the beginning restless, laughing, whistling, making jokes. Here and there, some stood up. Kessler goes on to describe quarreling in the loge between the composer Debussy and the Italian writer and nationalist D'Annunzio. As arguments and loud clapping and stomping broke out, the dancers, he wrote, without flinching, danced fervently in a prehistoric fashion. That eyewitness account tells us something about what this particular museum director, patron, and patriot thought at the time. And we know that some of the people responsible for the production were not all that upset.
Certainly Diaghilev, the promoter, was thrilled. I mean, scandal is good. I wish for scandal. I wish desperately that every concert I give would anger somebody.
Conductor Leon Botstein.
Outrage someone.
Stravinsky tried on a lot of different hats over the years.
Writer and USC professor Tim Page.
But I don't think he ever got quite as completely radical and shocking as he did with Rite of Spring.
And audiences love it because it's a sensual thrill. It makes a racket. It is absolutely riveting to listen to. Because he was writing movie music before there were movies. There was a scenario.
Even the composer himself wasn't sure exactly where the score came from.
And you can really believe Stravinsky when he said he was just sitting there and this music just seemed to visit him. It seemed to come through him from some unknown source. It's just extraordinary to think about him sitting there creating this piece bar by bar.
I got a chance to see a copy of the manuscript of The Rite of Spring.
Cellist Fred Sherry.
And you can see how fast Stravinsky wrote that, because it's like you see in some Bach manuscripts that the way he wrote is on a slant. Like, he couldn't write faster. He's just writing, and this is a slant because the music is facing forward, even, you know, on the page. And after it was done, he never stopped tinkering with it. Every time he'll say, oh, he'd come to conduct the Rite of Spring, he said, oh, that timpani note, could you put it here? There must have been things that he heard, like, why didn't I do that? And the answer is, he wrote it too fast to even be able to think about some of the niceties of editing.
Although everyone agrees that one of its contributions is editing, the way it brazenly moves from one section to the next. This is a piece of music that simply cuts to where it wants to be and hang the transitions. It is pretty shocking. As for that riotous first night, you have to figure that Parisians' affection for scandal must have played a role, too. Because after giving 6 performances of the Rite in Paris, the Ballet Russe moved on and went to the Drury Lane Theatre in London, where the British audience gave the ballet a measured reception with polite applause. And the fact is, after the initial shock, people fell in love with the music, even the French. Later, Disney used it. Film composers copied it. You can find it hidden in plain sight in any number of the most beloved movie scores, including Godfather 2. But it is revered still. The Eiffel Tower principle applies once again. People thought it was ugly, then they kept hearing it, and then, after a while, they admired it. This is a cultural moment full of that kind of shock. And, of course, the next chapter of the story would take us to World War I. In fact, 1913 is of even greater interest because it came just before 1914, and that most earth-shaking and world-changing event. The French poet Charles Péguy didn't even know it was coming when he said in our year 1913, and I quote, "The world has changed less since the time of Jesus Christ than it has in the last 30 years."
It's interesting to me to hear that quote, because I think I hear people say that so much today about even the last decade, that what has happened essentially digitally has so completely transformed our world. And certainly one of the things that modernism, with a capital M, has in common with whatever we are today is that underlying anxiety
Today there is a multitude of power centers and possibilities and social visions and market economic ideas, and we don't know who or what will win. That was very much something that I think people before the First World War also felt. They felt there were all these forces swirling around, and they didn't know which one would really dominate and which one would be sucked under again. And then, of course, there's the historical change that we've had to come to terms with, a complete change in our societies, in their social structure. All that has happened in the last four or five generations, and we still have so much to digest from the century that preceded us.
So maybe this is our time to process the last decades and the last century. It could be we're about to experience the next great cultural explosion when artists, as they did a century ago, help us sort it out, with sometimes shocking results.
You've been listening to Studio 360. Today's special program was devoted to Culture Shock 1913, produced by Sarah Fischko for WNYC. And that's it for today's show. Let us know what you think at studio360.org. The production team for Culture Shock includes Laura Mayer, Karen Frillman, Wayne Schulmeister, Edward Haber, and Carla Green, with help from Frederick Castell and Evan Spritzer in Paris and Carrie Skyring in Vienna. Karen Ludwig read the passages from Gertrude Stein. Special thanks to Dean Capello, Chris Bannon, and Kathleen Ehrlich. I'm Kurt Anderson. We'll be back next week. In the meantime, Happy New Year.
Support for Studio 360 comes from Scion. Scion has helped others follow their passions for nearly 10 years. For those who've started turning their passion into a profession, Scion wants to help you take it to the next level. Business plans seeking help are now being accepted at scion.com/motivate. By Ken and Lucy Lehman, who believe that winning workplaces respect, reward, and invest in their employees. By the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art. And by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360, what's the creative project you've been meaning to do for years?
This year, I will write a short story every month.
We're going to make it happen in 2013.
I've decided it's about time I fulfilled my promise.
The pressure's on.
And I'm resolving to get it done in 2013.
Your creative New Year's resolutions next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
You've been listening to Studio 360 with Kurt Anderson from Public Radio International and WNYC. You can find out more about this episode, access our entire program archive, and leave us a comment at studio360.org.